You're listening to The Tales We Tell, a podcast about spooky stories, unsolved mysteries, and local lore. I'm your host, Hannah Parch.
And I'm Katie.
Welcome back to the house. It's been a minute.
It has. But it's a Thursday, so there's that.
Ooh. Oh, it is a Thursday.
Yeah. How about that?
Look at that.
Real quick, I wanted to give a shout out to my friend Kara.
Okay.
Who, she's a fellow keeper like me. Ooh. And we were at a meeting 2 days this week, and I told her about the podcast. Mm-hmm. And she texted me this morning. She's like, so I started listening, and I was listening to the Ocean is Trying to Kill You episode. This is great. Thank you so much for sharing it with me. So, hi, Kara. I'm glad you like it.
Yay! Hi, Kara. Thank you for listening.
Told her I'm going to send her some stickers.
Yes. My two shout-outs are also to new listeners that I are also people I am friends with. So, the first one is another Hannah. I met her in my Lyra class, and also she was at a wedding that I was also at, so we found out we had friends in common, and she's very nice and supportive, even though I can't do anything in the classes, and she also has been very supportive because I've bailed on her a few times because of, like, mental health stuff, and she's been very sweet about it. So hi, Hannah. And also, Marzan, she works with Jarek, and she is the one who did the aerial fitness stuff. I think she's taking over that gym. Anyways, she also listens, and she's also super nice, and yeah, so that's all I wanted to say, is hi, Marzan and Hannah, thank you for listening.
Hi, new listeners, and hello again, gentle listeners, yes. Old listeners.
Old listeners.
Glad to have you back.
We actually have updated drinking game rules that Josh did for us. I am going to save them for next week, just because this is going to be a long episode, and I'm not trying to tack on too much stuff at the beginning. And next week's will be more normal. So, if you want to see them, you can become a patron and look at them on our Patreon. Okay, so that's pretty much it. The other thing I was going to say is just thank you for everyone who's been, like, supportive and sweet and nice, and there's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that goes on for us to put out an episode every week, and my week has been really sucky, and everyone has been very nice, so just thank you for being, like, such a kind community.
We love hearing from y'all, whether it's you know, comments on our Instagram photos, Instagram being The Tales We Tell Podcast,
yep.
Or actual messages to and from.
Yes.
And it's always great to get the feedback and get story suggestions, yeah. Which someone, a new listener,
yes,
suggested a story that we are working on right now. So that'll, yes, be coming out soon too.
Yes. We also enjoy getting to know people. Like, I've been having a conversation with Kelly, our listener from North Carolina, who's living in China. She's about to move to Vegas. Like, she's all over the place. But I've been talking to her, and she's, like, super cool. So anyways, thank you, everyone. All right. So Katie does not know the topic of today's episode. Obviously,
just like every other week, I have no idea what you're about to tell me.
Well, I was going to say, obviously everyone else who clicked on this episode knows what it's about. So Katie's
the only one. You're all at an advantage.
But I'm going to try to make Katie guess, because I brought Shelton into it, and I'm going to read you the text that I sent him and see if you can guess the topic based on the question I asked him.
Well, I already have a general area.
Go ahead. I don't know. Okay. Mind you, it took him another full day to reply, which is fine, because he said he was in Virginia. So, all right. Quick pharmacy question. Does hydrocyanic acid have any antiseptic properties? Also, would daily doses of morphine affect one's behavior or memory? I'm not going to tell you his answer yet, because that's part of the episode. So, you get to... any guesses?
Drug addiction?
No. It's a kind of obscure reference to the story.
Okay, well, no, I don't have a guess. Sorry. Okay.
Well, today we are talking about Lizzie Borden.
Nice. Never would have guessed Lizzie Borden off of that clue.
I'll tie it all in. This is also why we're drinking red wine, because I felt she very much deserved a red wine story.
Yes. My color of blood.
Yep. And as always, pictures for the episode are on our Instagram. They're also, I just recently started adding them to our Patreon early episodes that come out on Tuesdays per a listener suggestion. So you can see them either places. And I will include pictures for this one. All right. So do you know the rhyme, the Lizzie Borden rhyme?
How does it start? Something about 40 by, hold on. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her father 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her mother 41, or yeah. Mother then father, whichever.
Yeah. Mother first, yeah. I think, typically. We will get into whether or not that's accurate. Okay.
I've actually done some of my own research on Lizzie Borden, and because I love this story, because obviously we're twisted. Also, there's this great TV show called Warehouse 13,
ooh.
Where basically historical artifacts or just personal items mm-hmm. of, you know, famous or important influential people from history mm-hmm. have been imbued with some sort of kind of supernatural
ooh.
Power based on characteristics uh-huh. of who owned it. Like, I think it was Tesla's lab coat and goggles made you basically like a walking magnet
nice.
In a lot of static electricity. And then Lizzie Borden, mm-hmm. apparently she has a little compact, like a little mirror.
Uh-huh.
And whoever has this mirror, and if they look into it, it turns them, or it pushes them into this, like, fit of jealous homicidal rage.
Ooh.
Yep.
That's kind of cool.
So, yeah, Warehouse 13. I think it's on Netflix or Hulu. Can't remember.
Okay.
But I recommend it.
I will look into it. Well, I'm going to start at the beginning. The reason I didn't want to do this as a two-part episode is because I did not feel like this story, like, breaks into two parts easily.
Well, everyone kind of knows the story.
Yeah.
They know some version of it, so.
Yeah. And it, I don't know. I'm not gonna. Anyways, so just everyone buckle up. You already know. You guys know how long this episode is. We have no idea how long it's gonna be, so. Here we go. Lizzie Andrew Borden was born July 19th, 1860, to Sarah Anthony Morse and Andrew Jackson Borden in Fall River, Massachusetts. She had an older sister, Emma, who was 9 years older than her. So Andrew Borden was, he came from a wealthy slash influential background, but when he was on his own, he kind of struggled a little bit financially, worked really hard. He eventually became a successful property developer and owner of several textile mills. He was also the president of the Union Savings Bank and eventually the director of the Durfee Safe Deposit and Trust Company.
Definitely sounds like he was successful after all yeah. the hard work.
And at his death, his estate was worth $300,000, which is the equivalent of approximately $9 million today.
Not bad.
So, doing okay. In 1863, so Lizzie is 3, Emma is 12, right? That math works. Mm-hmm. Sarah, their mother, dies. Don't know what she died of. It is not important.
It was the 1800s.
Yeah.
Take your pick.
She was probably in her old age at that point in her...
The ripe old age of 35.
Yeah. And 2 years after that, in 1865, Andrew remarries to Abby Durfee Gray, who is 37. So Emma and Lizzie are young when this happens, but if you know anything about the story, Lizzie at least does not really take to her stepmother. In 1872, Andrew purchases a home at 230 2nd Street, 230 space 2nd Street. It's just one block from Fall River's busy city center, and he immediately has the home remodeled for his family. But despite his wealth, Andrew is known to be pretty frugal with his money, and the house on 2nd Street lacked indoor plumbing. It was not super nice. Like, it was, like, adequate.
And this was before or after his renovations?
This is after his renovations.
So he renovated it, but did not update it to the modern conveniences.
No, he did not.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool, Andrew.
Yeah,
go.
Cool. And this is kind of a random fact, but there's no hallways in the house except for the upstairs landing, which I thought was interesting. Also, I did...
Open concept.
Open, yeah. Or, yeah, I guess that is what that is. I watched one of the Lizzie Borden movies. I'll tell you which one later. But all I could think about was this story takes place in August. They talk repeatedly, like, historically about how hot it was that summer. And I'm just like, everyone's walking around in this house that has to be, like, 90 degrees. Everyone is wearing, like, to bed, they're wearing these, like, long...
Frilly nightgowns,
like, long sleeve, neck up, under the covers. And I just have to say, we just spent a weekend up at Jarek's family's cabin in Pennsylvania that has no air conditioning. And it was all I could do to not sleep, like, butt naked because I was in a room with, like, four other people.
Well, also remember that their hot summer is probably our version of a, like, nice, balmy summer day.
Yeah, but still. Because
temperature increase, hot. Climate change.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Also, everyone was shorter, right?
Sure. I don't know how much shorter they were. Like, yeah, sure, when we were
an
Australopithecus. Like, Lucy, the Australopithecus, before we were, like, full hominids, yeah, we were definitely shorter.
I feel like everyone in the turn of the century was, like, 5'5", tops.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. People were a little bit shorter. They were a bit shorter a long, long time ago. But in the 1800s, a little bit shorter, yeah.
Okay. Okay, so there was... So they live in an okay house. No air conditioning, obviously, because that wasn't invented, but no plumbing, which was invented. There is a more affluent neighborhood known as The Hill, and that is where many of the Borden cousins lived. And it was further away from the industrial areas of town. It was, quote, more homogeneous.
Homogeneous?
Mm-hmm. Damn it.
I mean, they both work, homogeneous and homogeneous.
Okay. It was more homogeneous racially. Sorry, I'm going to start that over because I tried to change.
It was all white people?
Yeah, it was basically all white, all rich,
affluent.
English, of English descent, because there was also a lot of, like, there were Irish immigrants that were...
A WASP. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
There you go. Thank you for helping me stumble through a sentence that was literally a quote.
An acronym.
All right, so yeah, what Katie said. During this time, nativism was a big thing, and especially in the wealthier parts,
How times have changed.
I know, shocking. Yeah. There was a big influx of Catholic immigrants, and the ones that I saw mentioned of were Irish and Portuguese. So, I guess people were mad about that. And allegedly, also maybe understandably, Lizzie was pretty resentful of the fact that her father wouldn't relocate them to this nicer part of town, even though they could very clearly afford it.
Yeah. It's like, well, why do our cousins get the toilets and we don't?
Yeah, honestly, if it was I mean, I don't know. If I never had a toilet, I don't know if it'd be a huge thing, but I can see being a little PO'd that if dad's got a lot of money and we're living in this, like, if you're sharing a room or something.
So, I mean, we're not rich by any means, but, you know, we were well off, I guess is the way to describe it. Like, we were comfortable.
Right.
And part of the reason is because we always lived below our means.
Right.
My dad is very much like Andrew. Now, he would totally make sure that the house had plumbing. That is for sure. However, growing up, I think I may have told this story before, but when I was home alone, even during the summer, I wasn't allowed to turn the AC below 83 degrees.
Oh, gosh.
And this was New Orleans, you know, August. Ugh. Heat of the heat and humidity, and so I would just, like, lay under the fan at full speed on the marble floor, just sweating because it was so hot. And after a while, I got real sneaky, and I would wait until it was, you know, getting close to just past, like, the hottest part of the day, and it was starting to cool off again. I could make it till then I'd turn the AC all the way down to 81. And I would make sure that, like, an hour or so before he came home, I would turn it back up.
To 81.
So I'd turn it back up to 83, and so he'd be none the wiser. And I had to, you know, I couldn't turn it down real low because he would notice that on the electric bill. Mm. So I had to be real sneaky about it.
I will say one of my favorite things about being an adult is...
Controlling
the thermostat. Although I grew up in a very cold house, but... It's also something I'm very thankful that Jarek and I are the same about, is that we both love a cold house. So our house stays consistently at 69 degrees.
Which is why I always have a blanket on my lap when we record.
Yes. So anything over... Honestly, when I wake up and it's 71 degrees in the house, I'm sweating. So Anyways, I also have other fun anecdotes from the weekend, and I will save those for our bonus episodes on Patreon, which those are coming out. Okay, so Lizzie and Emma both lived at home with their parents well into adulthood. Some might call them spinsters, but I reject that label and just call them young women living at home. Both of them were very active in church activities. Lizzie taught Sunday school to immigrant children. She was the secretary/treasurer for the Christian Endeavor Society. She was a member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and she was also a member of the Ladies Fruit and Flower Mission. Also, according to an article on the Smithsonian website, she was known as, quote, Fall River's most prominent Protestant nun, which was a term, I don't know if they use it then, but the Smithsonian is using it now, a term for unmarried women who are kind of choosing to remain single for their, like, piousness. They don't want to accidentally choose the wrong man to marry, and so it was kind of looked at more like a choice, like, I'm choosing to stay single.
Get thee to a nunnery.
Yes. Although I will say, not a bad option, like, if your dad's rich and, like, you're gonna inherit all the money, like...
Well, are you? I don't remember what inheritance rules and laws are like at that time, but...
Well, she does end up inheriting all of her father's money. Man, there's so many theories in this. Okay, I'm just going to...
One of my questions, like, which you answered with that mm-hmm. was, you know, the fact that they were, you know, well into adulthood and never mm-hmm. married, still lived at home. I wondered if that was went along with, you know, maybe Andrew wasn't just frugal, mm-hmm. but also very selective about who courted his daughters.
Yeah.
And, but...
There's a lot of...
Sounds like, at least in Lizzie's case, it was very much... Selected.
There's not any like hard evidence that Andrew was like a very controlling or strict father.
Just frugal.
But there's a lot of speculation. For example, the movie that I watched showed him as not wanting Lizzie to go out and be social and wanting her to stay home and, mm-hmm. you know, keeping things very strict.
I mean, and Lizzie's own piousness, you know, self-inflicted celibacy, whatever, mm-hmm. could also be a sort of, like, Stockholm Syndrome type conditioning yeah. of her father's.
Well, despite her Christian activities, some might find it shocking that Lizzie was not very Christian-like in her attitude towards her stepmother, Abby. Sometime during her adulthood, she started refusing to call her mother. She insisted on calling her Mrs. Borden, and she believed that Abby married her father for his money.
Not that they got to spend any of
it. Yeah. Which, like, she married your father when you were 3. Like, when did you come up with this theory that it was for his money? So, whatever. In addition to Andrew, Abby, Emma, and Lizzie, they also had a housekeeper. Who was an Irish immigrant named Bridget Sullivan. She went, the family called her Maggie, and I did not look into this because it was just literally in the movie I watched, which I promise I watched after I did all of my research, so my research is not, like, influenced by this. But in the movie, they made it sound like Maggie was just, like, a kind of a, not a derogatory term, but, like, they're like, we're not going to call you by your Christian name.
Kind of like Mammy.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to try my hardest to call her Bridget, but I wrote it as Maggie everywhere, so sorry in advance. Bridget lived with them. She lived in the 3rd floor bedroom, and according to...
The attic.
The attic bedroom.
A very hot house.
Yes. According to Bridget, the Borden girls rarely ate with their parents, so they were kind of independent, didn't really socialize with their parents.
Well, I mean, they were adults at
this
now,
is true.
So.
Yeah. In 1891, there was a daytime robbery at the house. Emma, Lizzie, and Bridget were all home. Cash and jewelry were taken from the home. And Lizzie had previously been accused of shoplifting by a local merchant. So her family kind of suspected that it was her, not a random intruder. And after that incident, the doors of the home, both inside and outside, were kept locked most of the time, which is semi-important. In 1892, May of 1892, Andrew kills a bunch of pigeons in his barn with a hatchet, which is significant only because Lizzie was very fond of said pigeons. Andrew claims that they were attracting local children to, like, trespass on their property and hunt them, which I don't know how you hunt a pigeon, but...
Now I know that she's cracked. She likes pigeons or any birds.
In the movie, it frames this as his revenge against Lizzie because he realizes that she burglarized the house as a way of acting out. All that I know from the research is she had built a roost for them in the barn. She was kind of fond of them. She kind of looked after them as pets. And it's not clear if Andrew had a real purpose for killing them that was not aimed at hurting Lizzie. But it happened with a hatchet, which is
foreshadowing.
And understandably, Lizzie was very upset. I was very upset by the scene in the movie because it's very violent to watch a bunch of pigeons get hacked to death.
I don't like birds, but I also don't like watching animals get murdered.
Yeah, it's a violent way to go. Sometime in early 1892, so I don't know if it was before or after the pigeon incident, Andrew gifted Abby's...
It's a good band name, the Pigeon Incident.
Pigeon Incident. Andrew gifts Abby's sister a house of some kind.
So, does this house have plumbing?
Unclear. And Lizzie and Emma are upset by this because they're like, hello, we're your daughters. Give us something too. So Andrew sells them their childhood home. So the house that they lived in with their mother until her death. Mm-hmm. He sells that to them for $1, which I think is the equivalent to about $30. And my understanding, it was intended to be used as a rental house, but then in July of that same year, they sold the property back to Andrew for $5,000, which is about $144,000. So I don't know if that was the plan all along, if, like, for paperwork reasons, they were like, he was like, I'm going to sell you this house for an amount of money.
So,
and you have to keep it for at least a month before you can sell it back.
So if someone were to just give you a car, mm-hmm. you would actually still have to pay, like, a gift tax mm-hmm. on that. So, or they would. I don't know exactly how it all works, but I know that there's, like, a thing called the gift tax.
Right.
And so that's why people are like, here, I'm giving you this car. Or no, I'm not giving you this car. I'm selling you this car for $1.
Right.
And that's just kind of a way of avoiding extra taxes and having to pay extra things on it. And if that was that's probably why he sold it to them for $1.
Right.
Now, if that was the intention of, like, okay, I'll sell it to you for $1 and then later I'll buy it back from you for what was it, $5,000 you said?
Mm-hmm.
That may have been his way of giving them money.
Right.
Without having to pay any taxes on it or anything.
That's pretty smart. Although, again...
I don't know anything about taxes, though, so...
I feel like I'd be real annoyed if... I mean, whatever, I shouldn't say that. First of all, I'm not going to apologize, because my parents don't have money, so... it's not like the situation ever came up. But I get the kind of pretentious tone of, like, well, if my dad has money, he should just give it to me. Whatever, it's his money, do what he wants. Okay, so that was in July. Also in July, there is some kind of family argument that prompts both sisters to take a, quote, extended vacation to New Bedford, where they stayed for several weeks. I would also like this to return as a thing, because I would like to take an extended vacation somewhere.
Me too.
Right?
Extended vacation at the murder cabin.
There you go. That has no air conditioning.
Don't need it. We still have to sleep with two, like, a comforter and an extra blanket on the bed, because it's still so cool at night.
Ugh. I was further north than you. How did this happen? Oh, man. All right, so they return at the end of the month, and Lizzie allegedly stays in a local rooming house for 4 days before she comes back to her father's house. So she's kind of getting the impression she doesn't really want to come home. She's like, fine, I'm back in town. I'm just going to stay at the motel down the road for a little bit before I come home. On August 2nd, 1892, Abby and Andrew wake up feeling ill, possibly Bridget also, unclear. Abby goes to the doctor. She tells him that she thinks she was poisoned. And the doctor's like,
it's probably just hysteria.
Probably not. It's probably because it's 1892 and nothing's refrigerated.
Have you had any water to drink lately? Yes, I've been drinking plenty of water. Well, that's probably your problem.
That's probably
right
what
there.
It is. Yeah. Have you been boiling it? The following day, on August 3rd, Lizzie goes to the local drugstore and tries to buy hydrocyanic acid. She visits with her friend Alice Russell and tells her that she's seen a bunch of shady people around her house recently. And she said she's worried that someone's going to try and poison them. With what? Who knows?
This is like Belle Gunness again with setting up that alibi.
I know. She's like...
going around town. I feel like someone might shady people
cut my head off and burn my house down.
They look like poisoners.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not entirely sure how to describe what poisoners look like, but they definitely do. They look like. If you want to know what a poisoner looks like, these people.
These people that have been hanging around my house that I've definitely seen.
I've seen them. I don't know if you'll ever see them.
No, they're really...
It's like, they're real shifty.
Yeah.
But, definitely poisoners, and I'm really worried about that. They might try and poison everyone in my family except for me and maybe my sister.
Yeah, it's... I don't know.
Spread that around, won't you?
Yes. She also mentions that her father has enemies, so probably in relation to the shady people. Their uncle, John Morse, so their mother's brother, also arrives on this day randomly to stay with them for a couple days. He just kind of shows up. The following day, August 4th, 1892, Abby, Andrew, and John all have breakfast together around 7 a.m., which is very early for breakfast. Lizzie and Bridget are also home. Emma, I'm not sure if she's home in the morning, but during the day she is visiting a friend, so she's not really on the property. After breakfast, Andrew and John go into the sitting room, and Bridget is sent outside to clean the windows. There was an interesting little, like, blurb at the end of a sentence for this fact where it says, and Bridget goes outside and throws up. So I was like, what? I guess she
didn't want to wash the windows that day.
Well, and I guess that she had also been affected by the illness and she wasn't quite recovered yet. Because they also mention she's not feeling well, it's super hot outside, and she's having to spend the whole morning outside washing windows, which... yeah, whatever. Meanwhile, Abby goes upstairs to clean up the guest room where John had slept that night. And around 8:45, John leaves to go buy a pair of oxen and visit another one of his nieces. And he plans on returning to the Borden house around lunch, or around noon for lunch. So he's going to come back. And then shortly after 9, Andrew goes for a walk and possibly to the post office to mail some letters for Lizzie. So it's unclear if she sent him, if she was like, hey, I have these letters to mail, can you go?
Oh, you're going for a walk? Would you mind walking by the post office?
Yeah, you know, take a little extra time. Between 9 a.m. and 10:30 a.m., somewhere in there, Abby is attacked in the guest room. Forensic evidence suggests that she was facing her attacker.
Sorry. Just knowing the time period and just using the word forensic evidence. Oy.
I mean,
that's a laugh.
What I think that means is the injuries on the side of her head indicate that she was facing her attacker. She was hit on the side of the head first, just above her ear, with a hatchet. That caused her to fall to the ground. And then her attacker struck her in the back of the head with a hatchet 17 times. So not quite 40, but 18. So
definitely overkill.
A little bit of overkill. I think maybe one might have done it. Probably. Honestly,
Or at least two. Just make sure, like, you did it right. Because hatchets, they're a little bit unwieldy, especially if you're a frail woman.
This is true.
So,
or a shady man that's hanging out by the house.
Oh, yeah, shady man. Like, you could be just like a hobo looking for some food, and you got to kill the folks to make sure that you don't get caught and sent to the clink.
I will say also, if you're not in a hurry, probably just the one whack would do it if you're willing to wait for some infection to set in. And it's 1892, so what are we going to do? Also, as a side note, I did read somewhere that... you know how there was a time period where people were just getting killed by axes, right? Apparently, most of the time when that was happening, the killer would just grab the axe that was at the house already, like by the wood pile, and use that. Okay, no one do this, but we have an axe in our garage, and I told Jarek, like, it's by our firewood. I was like, I feel like maybe we should put that in the locked part of the garage because someone could just get that and then break into our house and kill us with it. So, Jarek, if you're listening, while you're listening to edit this, this is your reminder to move the axe into the locked part of the shed.
And break. Add time.
This episode of The Tales We Tell is brought to you by Van Ness Agency. Does your marketing suck? Did you get sold by some big-time agency and then passed along to some random? At Van Ness Agency, their superpower is being a boutique agency, and you get to speak with the owner yourself. Call them today if you need to be saved from your current marketing. 910-370-8706. Again, that's 910-370-8706 for Van Ness Agency. Andrew returns home around 10:30. He has trouble getting the door open, so he calls for help. And Bridget comes inside and tries to get the door open, and it is jammed for some reason. She's having trouble, and so she curses. And
I bet I know why it's jammed.
Someone put a toothpick in the lock keyhole in that thing? Put a toothpick in the keyhole and
maybe, can't.
I'm not a criminal. Anyways, Bridget curses in frustration, and she later testified in court that when she did that, she heard someone giggle upstairs, and I kind of got the impression that it was like, maybe Maggie, or maybe Bridget doesn't curse that much, maybe she's kind of uptight, and so, you know, when you hear someone, like a nun curse, it's funny. It's like when a baby curses. And so she said she heard someone giggle from upstairs. At this point, we know Abby is dead. Anyone who would be on the second floor would have seen Abby's body. So, draw your own conclusions. Lizzie, on the other hand, claims she was not upstairs. I don't know where she was at this point. But she comes to meet her father at the door. She says, oh, Abby got called away to visit a friend who was sick. So Andrew goes to have a rest on the sofa. Lizzie claims that she helped him change into his slippers, although there's a very clear crime scene photo that shows him still wearing his boots. So, and then Lizzie tells Bridget, hey, there's a sale at the local department store. Don't you want to go? And Bridget, who I think is having like the worst day ever, apart from Abby and Andrew, is like, I'm fucking hot. I have been outside washing your damn windows. I'm also still, like, poisoned.
I just want to go take a soak in the creek.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a tub here.
She's like, I'm going to go just lay down. And she goes up to her room in the attic. One thing I couldn't figure out, which I'm sure anyone who has visited the Lizzie Borden house, which you can visit, I looked into it for us, it's like $300 a night. I want to know what way she took to get up to, like, if there was a separate staircase to get up to the attic versus just walking up the regular steps. Because if she walked up to the second floor first, she would have seen this horrific scene.
Right.
So, I don't know. If you've been to the Lizzie Borden house and you know the answer, tell me, please. Just before 11 a.m., Bridget hears Lizzie call her downstairs. So, mind you, Andrew comes home at 10:30, Bridget goes up to take a nap, and then less than 30 minutes later, Lizzie's calling her down, and she's like, fuck, just trying to nap. So Lizzie is calling her, and she says, quote, Maggie, come quick. Father's dead. Someone came in and killed him. And so...
Wow.
So
Lizzie, girl, you got to work on your acting there. So
that was my best third grade play acting, my fake enthusiasm. Andrew is found slumped over on the couch where he had laid down, and he has been struck in the face 10 to 11 times with a hatchet. One of his eyeballs has been cut in half, and his wounds are still bleeding, which I thought meant that he was technically still alive, but apparently it just means it was a fresh
wound. Yeah, probably just oozing.
Gross. And there are pictures of both Abby and Andrew. They are 1892 pictures, so
grainy and black and white.
A little grainy and black and white, so they're not terrible but they're on our Instagram if you want to see those. And it's kind of gross. So just be forewarned. So Lizzie tells Bridget to go get the family physician, whose name is Dr. Bowen, who lives across the street. And he comes over and he declares time of death for Andrew approximately 11 a.m. So again, poor Bridget just trying to take a nap, and this is how her day goes.
Pretty much as soon as Lizzie was like, all right, she's all the way upstairs.
Door is closed.
Shouldn't hear me. All right, let's get to whack.
Let's do this. Okay, so Lizzie calls her friend Adelaide Churchill over to sit with her while the police are notified. And she tells Adelaide that she was out in the barn looking for sinkers for an upcoming fishing trip when the murder happened. She's like, I don't know what happened. I was out in the barn looking for fishing stuff. And she also says, oh, actually, I think Abby might have come home. Hey, can you guys go upstairs and look for her and see if she's up there? Because she, I guess, didn't hear me when I screamed, Father's dead! So, again, poor Bridget and Adelaide, now is being roped into this, start climbing the steps, and they get halfway up to where they can, like, see
the landing,
and they see Abby laying in a puddle of blood and scream, I assume. And so when the police get there, now they know there's two bodies. They bring both of them into the dining room and perform the postmortem exams there on the dining room table.
Cool.
Cozy.
Cool.
And meanwhile, Lizzie is interrogated, or at least questioned by the police.
Well, yeah, because she, other than Bridget, were the only ones there mm-hmm. when these mysterious attackers came in, hacked two people to death uh-huh. real quick, and got out without a trace.
Yeah.
All within, like, a 30-minute time period? Yeah,
pretty quick.
I mean, it's, you know, like, sure, okay, it's plausible that they came in, maybe to burglarize, right. you know, rob the place, thinking everyone was out for some reason, even though wasn't Bridget out washing windows outside
yeah.
and probably would have been visible to somebody who was coming to break in and steal things. But we'll just continue going with that. They
yep.
came in, they broke in, they were going to try and steal things, so they go upstairs to get the jewelry and the expensive stuff, and yep. oh no, there's the lady of the house.
Oh, let's no.
hatchet her to death.
Oh darn.
And then, okay, she's dead, I can start going through and looking for things. Oh wait, I hear people coming in the front door, I need to hide. You know, wait till the coast is clear.
Yeah.
Go downstairs. Oh no, I thought the coast was clear, but he's on the couch. I'm just going to hatchet him to death, too, and I'm going to get the heck out of here.
Yep, I'm going to leave, and I'm not going to actually take anything.
Or make any kind of mess or rummage, make it look like I was...
Right. Yeah, I'm just going to apparate.
I'm going to open the drawer and just look. I'm not going to touch anything.
Don't touch,
I'm not going to throw anything out. I'm just going to open it and put it back.
Yeah, nothing good here. Oops. Sorry, wrong house.
Yeah. Don't leave a hair out of place.
Yeah. Lizzie's talking to police. She's described as having a detached manner about the deaths. And she corrects an officer who refers to Abby as her mother. She says, quote, she's not my mother. She is my stepmother. I assume she said it with that inflection. Her story about what happened and where she was changes at this point. So first she says she came in and she heard a groan or a scraping sound. Then later she's like, no, I didn't hear anything. She basically says, I came in and there was nothing that would tell me anything was wrong. I didn't hear anything. And when asked about Abby, Lizzie says, oh, I thought she was still gone. I thought she was out. But earlier she had said, oh, I think she came home. Can you guys go look for her? No one checks Lizzie for blood. They do a very cursory search of her room, and they find nothing. Allegedly, Lizzie says she's not feeling well, which that part I think is understandable.
That I would believe. Like, okay, the detachment, it could be because she'd been planning this for a while.
Right.
Or it could be that, you know, like, everyone grieves differently, and mm-hmm. it could be that she was, like, whatever, good riddance, evil stepmother.
Right.
But possibly still upset about her dad, but not sure how to, like, she's just in that shock phase of, like,
yeah.
I don't know how to react. Do I cry? Do I wail? Do I faint? Do I
hard to know calm? In that time how yeah. a woman is supposed to react to, you know,
shock. Well, yeah, there's no man around to tell her. You know, like, her father was dead. He couldn't tell her how
Well, and famously, the manual on how women should act was not published until 1896. So, still had some time before that came out. Okay, so they leave. They don't do a thorough search. They're like, I guess we'll just let you stay in this house with your dead parents. Because they leave the bodies there, I think, for a little bit of time. And they search other parts of the house. They find two hatchets, two axes, and a hatchet head with a broken handle in the basement. The handle looked like it was broken recently, like it was a fresh break. And also, there was ash and dust on the handle that looked like it had been placed there deliberately to kind of make it look like it had been sitting for a while. None of the weapons were moved from the house, so they were just like, noted, there are several weapons in the basement. We're just going to leave those here. We're going to leave everyone in the house. We will come back later.
I'm going on break.
Yep. We'll resume tomorrow.
It's basically noon. We got to go get lunch, and then we'll come back after lunch.
Lunch and a couple beers. Yeah. Maybe martinis or something, and we'll come back like 4 o'clock. So, and then by then, time to wrap up. Got to go home. Yep. So we'll come back tomorrow. They do take the family's milk supply. And also, Andrew and Abby's stomachs were removed, and they test both of their stomachs and the milk supply for poison. None was found. I also cannot...
when they were clearly...
Well, because...
axed in the face. They had to
determine the cause of death, Katie, obviously, to see if they were...
Yeah, I understand that sometimes a bloody face full of axe wounds... I can see how that can be misidentified as poison, for sure. No, you're absolutely right.
That's why they did that. Also, what I can think of is warm milk. Like, I mean, I know they could refrigerate things, but also I'm just like, it's so hot. Who's drinking probably room temperature milk in such hot weather? The milk's probably spoiled. When confronted with the fact that Lizzie had attempted to buy hydrocyanic acid from the drugstore the day before, she said, oh no, I just wanted it to clean my furs. So this is why I texted your husband. Can you use hydrocyanic acid as an antiseptic? This is his response. Quote, not sure about the acid, but presumably yes, because the cyanide component will disrupt cell respiration, leading to cell death. Obviously, it's extremely poisonous to humans and animals. Presumably, this is effective against bacteria, but some yeasts have cyanide resistance. Long story short, I'd have to do some research, but it would be a terrible choice as an antiseptic because you'd likely kill yourself in the process.
Sounds like him.
And that is why I like him for medical advice, because these are the answers I get.
It's both very clinical and straightforward.
Yes. So, technically, yes, she may have been able to use that to clean her furs, but it's not a good choice. And I guess she would have poisoned herself in the process. A medical examiner also later would testify at the trial that the hydrocyanic acid did not have antiseptic properties. So, but I wanted to give Shelton the first bit on that.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is like, did you look up... you know, like, methods for cleaning furs, like, old-timey? Because, I mean...
No, I didn't. I'm not really giving Lizzie that much of the benefit of the doubt
either. That much credence to her story.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, I did try to look up, like, why would you buy hydrocyanic acid? But the first thing that came up is, like, super poisonous. I feel like the only reason you buy it is to poison someone, so...
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder, why do they sell it... Well, maybe they don't, because she wasn't able to buy it.
Yeah.
I don't know. They sold ether back in the day. Mm-hmm. Kill someone with that. Fun fact, go listen to our bonus episode about frogs and homemade bombs that my dad guested on with Jarek. Lizzie and Emma call their friend Alice Russell, the one Lizzie was telling about, the shady people. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, can you come stay the night with us in this house that our parents were just killed in? And also their bodies are still here because it's kind of creepy.
Their bodies, but not their stomachs.
Not their stomachs.
Most of their bodies.
Most of their bodies. Also, Uncle John comes back and stays, but not in the room where Abby was killed. There was a question about that. And then police are stationed outside of the house. So at least they were like, well, we're not going to take anything, but we'll just stay out here, I guess, and see if anyone
comes back to finish the job.
I don't know. They said that they saw Lizzie and Alice go down to the basement carrying a kerosene lamp and a slop pail. And then they also saw them both leave, but then Lizzie returned on her own. And they said also that it appeared that she was bent over a sink. I don't know where they're looking, like how they can see into the basement, but unless it's like a, like where you have like the windows. Yeah.
Maybe. And also, if she's bent over a sink, she might be wringing out a bloody rag from trying to clean up the blood from the floors and the furniture. Like,
this one officer was just like, I'm just going to observe these things.
I'm just writing down what I see, not editorializing.
He was probably very fed up with his job, and he was like, not my job to go in there. I'm just gonna write down what I see. That's all they told me to do. On April 6th, they do a more thorough search of the house. So after Lizzie's had a chance to clean everything. And this is when they confiscate the broken-handled hatchet and they inspect the sister's clothing. And that evening, they tell Lizzie that she is a suspect. And then they leave again. And then the following day, Alice is still hanging out with them. She walks in on Lizzie in the kitchen tearing up and burning a blue corduroy dress. And Lizzie was like, oh, I got paint on it. I just need to destroy this because there's paint on it. And I can't,
you know, just throw it out.
You know what they say, get paint on a dress, gotta burn it.
Burn it.
Get rid of it.
Because paint is toxic.
Paint is, you don't want to look at that. And it was never determined whether or not that was the dress that she was wearing. So, if for some reason you're listening to this and you don't know the story, because I realize we're talking about it in a very presumptive manner, the presumption is Lizzie killed her parents. It's a very well-known story in America.
There's a rhyme about it.
There's a rhyme about it, but we also have international listeners. I don't know.
That's true.
Anyways. So, yes, we are under the assumption that Lizzie is the one who killed her parents. On August 8th, they have an inquest hearing, and Lizzie's testimony is all over the place, and her behavior is described as erratic. First, she says she was in the kitchen reading when Andrew came home. Then she says she was actually ironing in the dining room. And then she says, actually, I was upstairs, and I was just coming down the stairs when he was coming home, which... probably that is what she was doing, but she might have just let that slip. She had been prescribed regular doses of morphine for her nerves, which her doctor suggested might explain her odd behavior.
And also not being able to remember where she was or what she was doing.
Yeah, and Shelton kind of confirmed that in his next text answer. He basically said, it's kind of like alcohol. Everyone has a different tolerance to it, so it depends on the dosage. She could have been really loopy. She could have been fine. Who knows?
Isn't that one of those things that you start to build up a tolerance of, too, and you have to take more and more, and it affects you more?
Probably. I don't know.
Anyway.
But they were also just prescribing morphine for, like,
anything.
I'm like, give me some morphine for... we're just doing that.
Just had surgery? Morphine. Stubbed your toe? Morphine.
Murdered your parents?
Morphine.
Hysterical? Morphine. The DA was also apparently pretty aggressive and confrontational, and I assume because of all of this, because of the DA's behavior and because of Lizzie's erratic behavior and the fact that she was doped up, her testimony was later deemed inadmissible. So, inquest hearing doesn't matter. On August 11th, Lizzie is arrested and put in jail.
I wonder why he was so aggressive. Like, was he looking to make an example of her for some reason?
I don't know. I guess. There's a lot of interesting theories about, like, public perception of her during the trial and after the trial and stuff. So, I don't know. November 7th, the grand jury begins hearing evidence, and on December 2nd, Lizzie is indicted on murder charges. So she has to wait until June 5th for her trial to begin, and it is in New Bedford. 5 days earlier, interestingly enough, there was a similar axe murder in Fall River, And I had to look this up because it was just odd. A woman named Bertha Manchester was found hacked to death in her kitchen. And I actually read the article that was printed in the Boston Daily Globe. Her body was discovered by her younger brother around 2 p.m. Quote, her head being crushed and her neck gashed until beyond recognition. It's actually kind of a gory article because it's like, and her brother, who was 15, would like ran out of the house hysterical, and her dad couldn't figure out what he was saying because he was overcome. And
what is it, Jimmy? Use your words. Ah, Helen, go get the morphine.
Yeah, give him some morphine. He'll calm down. They think that robbery was the motive since her watch was missing and some money that she kept in her bedroom is missing. They found a bloody axe near the woodpile out back. And the article does actually point out the similarities between this case and the Borden case. Mm-hmm. But they also ultimately acknowledge it's very different. And
because things were actually taken in this instance. There was some other evidence left at the scene.
Yeah. It seemed a little senseless. Like they talked about that Bertha was like the older daughter. So she wasn't, like, the head of the house. And they're like, she didn't really have any enemies. She wasn't dating anyone. Like, it seems
somebody
senseless.
Somebody broke in to steal things, and she was just there. Which kind of goes back to our hypothetical possible scenario. Right. In which someone broke in thinking the house was empty, ran into Abby, killed her.
Right.
Then heard people coming, tried to make an escape.
Right.
Ran into Andrew. Right. Killed him and then fled.
Yeah.
So, like,
super possible.
It's definitely possible, but with all the other information and details about this case, it's not likely.
Yes. Also, the following year, they actually did find who killed Bertha, and it was a Portuguese immigrant named José Carrera de Mello. And he was convicted of the crime, and they checked, and he was not in Fall River when the Bordens were murdered, so.
Gotcha.
Whoops.
I mean, that's not to say that two different criminals can't do the exact same crime, or mostly same crime.
Yeah, I mean, like we said, axe murder was a thing. It's just happening, so. All right, so Lizzie's trial. Initially, Lizzie has a lot of public support because she's a Borden. Everyone knows her.
Her family's dead. She's a victim.
Yeah, it's, you know, poor.
They didn't catch her red-handed, so we're going to go with, you know, innocent until proven guilty.
Yeah. There was some criticism that she was not going to get a fair trial because she would not be judged by a jury of her peers because women couldn't serve on juries. Because we also couldn't vote. Also in court, Lizzie presented herself as modest and demure, and newspapers were reporting that she didn't look strong enough to wield an axe. She was just a poor, frail woman. I mean, she can't do anything. The hatchet head that was recovered from the house was not convincingly demonstrated to be the murder weapon. Prosecution argued that the handle had been removed because it would have been covered in blood. But there was conflicting testimony about whether the handle had actually been found or not. So, basically, they don't have a murder weapon. I think the prosecution kind of stuff. They didn't find any bloody clothing. Alice did testify about seeing Lizzie burn the dress with the paint on it. And the defense never challenged this, but I think it was kind of like, okay, well, she said it was paint and you don't have the dress, so...
I mean,
who knows?
I mean, there's no evidence that there was ever even a dress at all, too. So it's like, you say she was burning a dress, but...
And I mean...
That's what you're saying. Like, you don't have remnants of the dress. Yeah. Or, like, there's just no proof of
that. Also, Alice is a woman, so, like, I don't know how reliable her memory is.
Probably hysterical.
Probably was just... She probably needs some morphine and...
Jimmy, get the morphine!
Bridget testified that she went up to her room around 10:58, so not even 10:30. Poor girl, 10:58. And then Lizzie claimed she went out to the barn at the same time, but Lizzie claimed she was in the barn for 20 to 30 minutes. And then two men testified later that they saw Lizzie leave the barn around 11:03, and it was 11:10 when Lizzie calls Bridget downstairs to get the doctor. So... there's literally 10 minutes between when Bridget goes upstairs and then Lizzie calls her downstairs. So I don't know if Lizzie was just banking on, like...
Also, this is how many months after the initial crime? And all, like, this is all circumstantial and witness testimony. Like, there's no actual evidence. This is all witness testimony, which is, you know, faulty because of human memories. Yeah. And the longer you go, the, you know, hazier and more unreliable your memory gets. Also, who the hell knows where they are and what they're doing at the exact time?
Yeah.
I can give you, I think it was sometime after 3 o'clock. Maybe I can go as specific as, like, sometime after 3:30. I cannot tell you that I went upstairs at 3:27.
Yeah, it's, that's true. And this is...
And I wear a watch. So, like, I have time literally strapped to my wrist. I could, potentially, but I don't.
Well, maybe Bridget was wearing a watch, because watches were a thing, remember? Because Bertha had her stolen.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this is 10 months after the crime, so whatever.
Almost a year later.
Yeah.
People have had time to, you know, like, especially the witnesses have time to tell and retell their stories. And, you know, each time you tell it, you know, it gets embellished or just a little bit different every time.
Yeah.
And your memory fades. And
yeah, because you might have started by saying, I don't know, it was close to 11, maybe 10:30 when I went upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time you've gone over that story over and over, you're like, it was definitely 10:58. And I remember...
In 26 seconds.
Because this rooster next door always crows at 10:56, and I had just heard that when I was taking my shoes off, and then I got distracted, and it takes me about 2 minutes to walk from here to over here and to get this other thing, and then I went upstairs, and so it must have been 10:58.
Yeah, and sometimes in an effort to remember something,
mm-hmm.
you, like, focus and, like, really struggle, and like, all right, this, and you overthink it and kind of really distort the actual events.
Yeah. Also, our perception of how long things take is so wonky because...
Well, time is an artificial construct developed by humans. It does not exist.
Okay, well, you're getting a little deeper than I meant. All I meant is in the mornings when I'm getting ready and it's 7:25 and I'm like, okay, I need to leave in 5 minutes. All I need to do is... put some mascara on and feed the dogs, and then somehow I'm walking out the door and it's 7:48. Anyways. Okay. The testimony about Lizzie trying to purchase poison the day before the murders ends up being thrown out, and I assume this is just because she can afford really good defense lawyers who get stuff thrown out. And ultimately...
Well, and again, this is just hearsay.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
it's just, you know,
like, did you write it down? Do you have a record of me asking for hydrocyanic acid?
Yeah.
No? Okay, great. Also, it's not relevant. Allegedly. I guess it's not really.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe it's not relevant because she didn't poison her parents. She axed them to death.
Yeah, and they took their stomachs and the milk, because apparently that's how you poison people.
Just put it in the milk.
With cyanide, is you put it in the milk. Good thing I don't drink milk.
Good thing.
Put
it in the wine.
But, so I guess, you know, because there was no evidence of poisoning, that it didn't really matter whether or not she was trying to buy poison or not.
Right.
Because, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
All that means is, like, yeah, sure, the murder was premeditated, but it probably was regardless, so...
You sound like a defense lawyer. All right, so ultimately, there's no apparent motive, there's no witnesses, and this is a crime that took place in the middle of the day, a block away from the city's busiest district. It doesn't make any sense. And apparently the prosecution isn't landing with anything. So on June 20th, 1893, the jury of all men... deliberate for 1.5 hours before returning a not guilty verdict. After her acquittal...
I would, too, with this evidence.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Air quotes, evidence.
I mean, also, though, I feel like the police maybe could have done a better investigation.
Oh, absolutely. Like, so, I mean, by today's standards, when we have forensic evidence, like, mm-hmm. sure, we'd have all the witness testimony and everything, but this would probably be a slam dunk forensically. Yeah. Like, they would have lots of, they'd be able to identify the exact murder weapon, mm-hmm. this, you know, hatchet head versus this other axe by the woodpile.
Right.
Fingerprints, blood spatter, everything.
Yeah.
But they didn't have all of that then.
Yeah.
They had their own very rudimentary version of forensics.
Yeah.
And maybe they did their best. Maybe they didn't.
I also feel like Lizzie could have done a better job giving herself an alibi. Like, wait more than 1 second after you've murdered your dad to call Bridget downstairs and be like, oh my gosh, look what happened.
Yeah, like, let him get cold for a while, right?
Yeah,
like, you know, go back out to the barn and let somebody else find them. I mean, that's why she told someone else to go and check and see if Abby was home.
Yeah.
Which, fishy. But... Yeah. I mean, yeah, let somebody call you and be like, oh, no, I had no idea.
Oh, no, I was in the barn with the pigeons.
How did I miss this?
Oh.
The ghosts of the pigeons.
Oh, well, yeah. The dead
pigeons are no more.
The pigeon bodies. Also in that movie, sorry to keep bringing it up, after he kills the pigeons, he forces Bridget to serve them for dinner that night.
Awesome.
Which was horrible. The movie does a really good job of making you
feel for Lizzie
and be like, yeah, I understand why you murdered your family.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so I wouldn't have convicted her either based on the evidence that, you know, or in whatever the prosecution presented, even though I for sure think she did it.
Yeah.
Like, they did not prove it beyond a shadow of a doubt that it was her.
It's almost like a Casey Anthony situation where... We all know she did it, but I think the jurors in that case were like, they had the death penalty on the table. Like, we couldn't convict her with the evidence that they have. We think she did it, but not enough to put her to death for it. Yeah. So
there's still reasonable doubt, and as long as that is there.
Yeah. In double jeopardy, so... So after her acquittal, Lizzie and Emma do move into a larger house in the Hill neighborhood. They did inherit all of their father's fortune. There was a fun little tidbit about because Abby died first, technically Abby's estate would go to Andrew, and then when Andrew died second, Abby's and Andrew's estates would go to the girls.
Mm-hmm.
So they inherited a lot of money. Lizzie starts going by Lizbeth. Probably pretty smart.
Yes. I mean, there's probably a big old smear campaign against you.
A little bit. She lives the lavish lifestyle that she had always kind of wanted. She has a staff and presumably indoor plumbing. But she
probably also has a staff to go out into public and run errands and take care of things for her so she doesn't have to be in the public view.
Yeah, because she is definitely ostracized by her community after the trial, which is interesting that they supported her at the beginning. And then when she was found not guilty, at some point, the tides turned and they were like, she probably did, though.
Well, yeah, they probably listened to it and were like, reasonable doubt, but also it really sounds like she did it.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then there was no TV, no Kardashians to gossip about, so you gossip about other people.
Maybe someone accidentally saw her, like happened to see her in the backyard cutting wood, and they were like, oh, she can actually wield an axe. We were wrong.
But if she can wield an axe, is she still a woman or is she a man?
That was the whole...
And if she's a man, then we totally could convict her.
That was the whole basis of her ostracization? I think it's
how... Nope.
Nope? That's not how you would say that?
Ostracization?
Hold on. Ostracization. Ostracization.
Ostracization.
Ostracization.
I think... I don't know if that's a word, whether you pronounce it my way or your way.
All right, whatever. But. That's why she was ostracized, is because people thought she was actually a man.
That's awesome.
And that's how it works. Okay.
And for the record, that's just us joking around. That's not actually what people
are
saying. Sometimes after that joke, I like to clarify that I'm just joking.
Yeah, we are joking. She was ostracized because she murdered her parents.
Allegedly,
not proven in a court of law. In 1905, Lizzie and Emma have a falling out, and Emma moves out of their big fancy house, and they never speak again. And Lizzie...
I'm sure there's limited information as to what led to the falling out.
Yeah, there. Someone said something about a fight or about a party, but I think possibly after the trial, tensions were kind of building, and...
I'm sure that Emma already had, like, she wanted to believe her sister.
Yeah.
Because it's her sister. But she had her little seeds of doubt.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that after several years of living with Lizzie, observing her behavior, maybe asking her about it again, like, tell me again. Like,
what happened again?
I know you already said this in the trial and everything, but, like, take me through the events again.
Yeah.
And those seeds probably just grew and grew until she was more like, nope, bitch, you did it.
Yeah.
You done did it. You guilty. I don't want to be around you.
Yeah. Well, Lizzie never married. She never had kids, so she lived alone. She died of pneumonia on June 1st, 1927, at the age of 67. And 9 days later, Emma died of kidney disease. So they died very close to each other. There are a lot of speculations about...
I'm shocked.
Well, let me tell you some of them. The first one, there is no evidence for. It's the theory that Lizzie was being physically and sexually abused by her father. And again, there's no evidence to suggest this, although they do mention if that had been the case, it was a very taboo topic and it wouldn't have been talked about. And
unless, you know, Bridget had seen or overheard or something and whispered it to a friend.
Right. And I think it's possibly more likely maybe that if there was any kind of abuse, you know, certainly emotional abuse, psychological abuse.
That'll agree with.
The typical emotional abuse that all women in the 19th century were facing by men. And I don't know. Okay, I'm not going to give that one a lot because that was not a huge one.
No, and I mean, there might be some psychologists who can, you know, talk more about that. But at the same time, I think they'd probably point more towards, you know, just the mental emotional abuse and then the pigeon thing being more of a trigger.
The pigeon thing is bad.
For things than any kind of sexual abuse.
Yeah. This is my favorite theory. The second one is that Lizzie and Bridget were secret lovers. And, okay, this theory, the way this particular part of it plays out is, I think, lacking. This says that they were secret lovers, Abby caught them and reacted poorly, shocking, and so Lizzie killed her, and then when her father reacted similarly to finding out that they were in a relationship, Lizzie killed him too.
I feel like it would be really weird if maybe Lizzie and Bridget were together, you know, being intimate, and Abby walked in and was like, oh, hell no, and then Lizzie somehow
grabbed
a hatchet
that I keep
and
next...
killed her. And now, all right, well, let's, it's not, we kind of killed the mood along with my stepmother.
Hold on, let's just finish
real quick.
So let's
just go downstairs away from this. We'll clean this mess up later.
Yeah.
But, like, let's go down, resume our intimate activities.
Well,
oh no, my dad walked in. Guess we gotta kill him too. I feel like he would react poorly to his wife being dead.
Also, she could have used, you know, the hatchet that you keep, like, under your pillow during your lovemaking?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she could have used that.
It under the pillow. Like, it's on the pillow next to it. It's a prominent feature in our lovemaking.
I mean, so she could have used that. But I think you're right. You wouldn't want... I mean, it'd be very messy. You do kind of kill the mood. You probably have to, like, kind of start all over again.
That's what I'm saying. They went downstairs. Yeah. Like, we'll clean this up later.
Do that later.
Or I'll order you to clean it up later, Maggie.
Yeah, good grief. This theory, as far as I could tell, was first put forth in Ed McBain's 1984 novel called Lizzie. It was also the theory in the movie I watched, which I watched the 2018.
I was excited to watch the movie that you keep talking about, but now, no.
Okay, let me tell you. I'm going to give you a quick synopsis.
I feel like that's even less credible than the father's sexual abuse.
Well, okay, so first, there's the Lizzie Borden movie that stars Christina Ricci, which is also pretty good in my opinion. This one stars Chloe Sevigny, which I never know if I'm saying her last name right, and Kristen Stewart. And Kristen Stewart plays Bridget, and Chloe plays Lizzie. And in this version, okay, my one criticism of the movie is gratuitous nudity. Didn't need to make Lizzie and Bridget both naked for the murders, but they did. And so,
spoiler.
In their version, Lizzie. Oh, okay. So in their version, Andrew is sexually abusing Bridget, but Bridget and Lizzie are having a relationship, and also Lizzie, whatever. So Lizzie's like, the only way out of this hell is to kill my parents. And she's like,
obviously,
we have to do it together. And so she gets Bridget to give Abby a letter that says, like, oh, your friend is sick. So Abby goes upstairs to change, and then it like pans over and she's standing on the corner naked with an axe. So she murders. So in their version, Lizzie murders Abby and then cleans her naked body off and puts on clothes. And then,
well, then clearly the dress did have paint on it because she wasn't wearing a dress.
Wait for it. Then she goes downstairs where Bridget comes in, undresses herself, and then goes to kill Andrew, who had been, because he had been, like, raping her. Mm-hmm. So it's supposed to be her, but she's a normal person and is like, I can't, I'm staring you in the face and I cannot hatchet you. And she's freaking out, and so then Lizzie comes and takes the hatchet from her and does it for her. And that's how she gets blood on her dress. That's, I'm sure, not what the official theory is. I will say, to the credit of this one, there were rumors about Lizzie later in life about her sexual orientation.
Always is with a single woman who never marries.
You know how we be. I said that like I was, no. One of my Facebook memories recently came up about 10 years ago, and it was like apparently being, I must have been older than 21, but it was like apparently being 21 and single warrants your family messaging on Facebook to ask if you're a lesbian, because my cousin had recently done that in a not very tactile way. He'd been like, he was like, oh, I like your profile picture.
By the way, are you gay?
Is that your girlfriend? I was like, wait, does the family think that I'm gay? And he's like, no, that's not what I meant. I was like, all right, I'll see you later.
Thanks, cuz.
Thanks. Okay, so there were rumors about Lizzie. There were not any rumors about Bridget, who left the Borden family after the murders. She eventually did go on to marry, like, a man, so, and that's not to say anything, but. I was worried
she was going
to
marry a turnip.
I mean, I'm just saying, marrying a man doesn't say anything about your sexual orientation.
Not in that day and age.
You know, whether you are attracted to women or not. Apparently, Bridget made a deathbed confession, allegedly. She made a deathbed confession saying that she altered her testimony to protect Lizzie.
Which she's also the one that said when she swore trying to get the door open, she heard a giggle, which is really kind of implicating.
Yeah. Maybe she was like, but it was like a manly giggle. It sounded like a man upstairs. I don't know. The third theory is that Uncle John committed the murders. The facts on this one, apparently he rarely visited the Bordens, like, ever, and he just happened to be visiting that week.
What's his motive?
Well, according to the movie, which is not factual, in the movie, Andrew gave John control of his estate so that when he died, John would have control over it and not the girls. But also in the movie, Lizzie burns the will. So after her parents are dead, they're like,
no, I mean, in the theory that Uncle John did it, what's,
I think,
what's
the theory
the motive
is
that,
money. Okay. I think he's thinking he will inherit his brother-in-law's fortune.
So, you know, I'm just passing through town. I think I'll stop in and
just
see my
murder Andrew.
See my in-laws and, you know, hey, mind if I stay here a night or two? Should like, sure. Oh, by the way, you know what? While you're here, I wanted to let you know that when I die, I'm going to leave you my estate.
Yeah.
Cool. That's a lot of money, huh? I don't really want to, like, you're looking a little healthy. Yeah. Feeling great.
Oh, yeah. Why don't you lay down?
I want the money now. Like, I just found out about it. I haven't had time for this greed to really set in. But, yeah, I don't need the time. I'm good. Like, let's get this money now.
Yeah.
You got a hatchet somewhere? Cool. Be right back.
It's for the pigeons, though. I just need to take care of some stuff. Apparently, he had a very, like, overly detailed alibi for the murders. Like, he was, like... And I thought it was kind of weird. It was like, he left to go buy 2 oxen and...
Well, yeah, you always buy a pair of oxen.
Well, I'm just saying. I feel like when police questioned him, he was like, I went down the road and I spent 2 minutes at a stoplight and then I saw a friend on the curb and I spoke to them for 7.5 minutes and then I continued a quarter mile down the road and I purchased 2 oxen and that took approximately 47 minutes.
Has it occurred to anyone that Uncle John might be on the spectrum?
That is not mentioned anywhere in the research, surprisingly. No one is talking about...
Well, I mean, if there's a theory that it could have been him because he has a suspiciously over-detailed alibi, like, sure, yeah, that is a little suspicious, but, I mean, if he's, like, literally, you know, identifying, I did this, and then I did this, and I did this, and I did this, I mean, he could be on the spectrum.
That's true.
Could have a little of the OC disorder.
I'm also speculating about how overly detailed his alibi was.
Right.
Police did consider him a suspect for a while, but then it obviously wasn't because
Lizzie. They went for Lizzie.
Lizzie did. The last one is possibly the dumbest.
Oh, I can't wait to hear it because these others have just been gems.
Okay, this one is that Bridget killed them because she was mad she had to clean the windows on such a hot day when she didn't feel good.
Well, no, that's just lazy speculation there.
I mean, I feel like if that was any part of the truth, it would be much more than just, I'm mad about this one time I had to clean the windows when it was hot. It was probably like, this family mistreats me all the time, and this is a terrible house to live in.
Yeah, no, and Bridget has been with them for years and years and years, right?
I think she's... Maybe a couple years. She hasn't been with them super long.
A couple of years. If you're going to snap over being told to clean the windows on a hot day.
Yeah.
If that's I'm sure she's been told to do things much
worse.
She's
probably had worse to deal with. But
so.
Anyway, that's all I have for speculations. And my last thing is, what do you think happened? I think, obviously, Lizzie did it. I honestly think that it was probably a combination of, like, being a woman at the time and feeling very trapped and
oppressed
and, like, if the only way you can get out of your family and find any freedom is to get married, but you don't want to get married, you just want to live your life for you, mm-hmm. I can see how, well, the only way I can get out of here and get some money is these people have to die, and they're kind of being jerks to me, so...
I definitely think she had some, like, psychological issues.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Whether it was, you know, inflicted, due to abuse, mm-hmm. or she was just wired wrong, or maybe it was all of the morphine screwing with her brain chemicals.
Yeah.
I mean, she had this festering hate for her stepmother all of her life, apparently, and, you know, she probably just started... fantasizing, wouldn't life be easier if they were gone? Like, every child has thought, like, I wish I didn't have parents.
Yeah.
And it's probably something that she just kind of ruminated on, you know, once, twice, another time, and every time it just got worse and worse.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to kill you all.
Well, like, and I think
what teenager hasn't been like, I hate you all.
Ooh. I think the thing that makes it, like, extra creepy, or, like, the thing that's so chilling about it isn't necessarily that she had motive and was able to kill her parents, but...
Motive, means, and opportunity.
Correct.
Defense lawyer Katie.
But that she... I think that's a prosecutor attitude.
Well, yeah, but the defense lawyer can ask, I mean, did the defendant have motive, means, and opportunity?
Okay. You're a scientist, not a lawyer.
I've been watching a lot of Bones that have science and law, so I'm basically an expert.
I was going to say, the fact that she was able to just calmly live her life afterwards like nothing had happened is, I think, the most chilling part. So,
Well, again, she had all that morphine for her nerves.
She did have a lot of morphine. I'm kind of thinking about asking my doctor for some morphine.
Yes, for my nerves.
Yeah.
I'm a woman. I'm hysterical sometimes, so.
Yeah, I am hysterical sometimes. Oh, man. JK, JK, JK.
So, yeah, what are your thoughts and theories? Yeah. Did she do it? How did she do it? What's the real story?
Yeah.
In between all of the changing of stories and testimonies and witness testimonies.
I want to know if someone has a good, plausible theory of her not doing it. Like, if someone else doing it. I want to hear those. Because I feel like we've... I don't know.
Yeah, I gave mine, but it was kind of boring.
I don't know. Anyways, thank you guys for sticking around for this long one. Jarek just came in to remind me that I have 10 minutes to, I guess, get to my class that I'm supposed to go to. And Katie has to go home to eat dinner.
Food.
But thank you guys for listening. What are our socials again, Katie?
Again, Instagram for pictures and extra fun content is the Tales We Tell podcast. And, you know, be sure to go check it out and not only look at the photos, but like them, you know, subscribe, follow, all that jazz, because it really does help, you know, garner more attention.
Yeah.
So you can help other people, other like-minded listeners, find us and enjoy us the way that you do.
Exactly.
We also have a Patreon, the Tales We Tell podcast, and a website for those of you who don't do social media but still want to see the pictures, thetaleswetellpodcast.com.
Yep. And we are about, hopefully by the time this comes out, we will have at least one new bonus episode out on Patreon. I'm hoping two. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about both of them, so.
And I've got a special treat planned for everyone.
I forgot about that. Katie's going to email me a surprise. So, thank you guys for listening, and we will see you next week. Bye.